Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 1:30 p.m. and that is Pacific Summer Time. Today is April 30th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I thought we'd kick off and talk a little bit about margin debt. There's been a lot of concern being expressed about the quantity of debt that's of margin debt in the market, and that's emblematic of speculation. And more importantly, that it had surged higher and that the pace of the advance is moderating. So that is generally representative of some risk getting taken off the table. And then also we have to, I think, remember that it was it took on cult-like status after the financial crisis, because margin debt peaked right ahead of the market peak in both 2000 and in 2007. So the peak that we've had recently is certainly being viewed by, in certain circumstances, and certainly among the more bearish portion of the market, as being a significant event, and that it could contribute to a kind of decline similar to what we had in 2000 and 2007. That, I think, is really something that we need to start to begin to talk about and to put into some context, because we're at a stage in the market cycle where the exaggerated quantity of money that's been printed over the course of the last 12 years is exaggerating every sort of metric. And margin debt isn't any different. So when we then think about how it is performed relative to the size of the stock market, well, then we get, I think, a different conclusion. Because yes, we've definitely seen that the pace with which margin debt has been expanding is now moderating, but it's quite different to the kinds of conditions that we had back before the financial crisis, and then back before the TMT bubble peaked in 1999-2000. The ratio had really only come back to the region of the trend mean. And then we can also look at this very long ratio. It's the ratio of margin debt to the stock market cap. And it's generally when we get up into the region of about 40%, then that's when you can really start to get worried about the quantity of leverage in the system. Of course, when we're starting to talk about the trillions of dollars and euros, yen and pounds that have been printed over the course of the last 12 months, well then, this law of round numbers and big numbers, it's distorting all manner of different price series. So there is a simple way of looking at all of this, and it's that we simply have to look at what is the source of these liquidity, and rather than looking at the metrics, look at the money flow. And when that money stops, well then that is going to have a distorting effect in the opposite direction for asset prices. And I just don't believe that we're there yet. Now, I was also thinking in here today about this company. It's Superconductor Technologies, and this is a good example of destruction of capital. So they have developed superconductors, and you can think about the news stories that have been coming out from MIT and other universities about fusion technology over the course of the last 4 or 5 years, and that they believe that they can get modular designs for fusion reactors because they now have access to much more powerful superconductors, which can create much more powerful magnetic fields in a much smaller space, and that is the reason that they can achieve something approaching an economic result from fusion technology. And it's companies like Superconductor Technologies have been able to pioneer this new technology. But pioneering the technology and selling it are two different topics entirely. Now, the share did spectacularly well for a brief period in early 2000, and since then, and there have been myriad examples of them going back to the market to raise capital, then on a split-adjusted basis, the share price peaked at almost $20 billion or $20 million a share, and now it's at $1.25. And I think that this is a good example because we have an example of a company here that has persisted for 20 years by consistently going to the market for additional capital and picking up very small government contracts along the way, but never reaching its full potential, never making any money, subsisting exclusively on issuing new stocks and disappointing investors for the long term. And we can think then about companies like ARK Investments that are investing in these kinds of companies that don't have earnings. Now, some of those companies will succeed, and some of them will generate earnings eventually, and then there will be others that will not. So I think it's interesting that we can look at OrganOvo. And if you read the story about OrganOvo, it's at least as inspiring as the fusion story attached to Superconductor Technologies. They are developing technology to grow organs, 3D printing organic material. And it's obviously science fiction-esque. They do have a working product, and they do not know how to make money from it. And they're having extraordinary difficulty in scaling it up to reach commercial utility. So ARK Investments owns a good share of the stock, and it occasionally pops on the upside, but it hasn't really done anything for the last 2 years. We can then think about the 3D printing companies. Again, it's an inspiring story. They have clearly defined base formations, and now we had the spectacular run on the upside in the early part of 2021, and it has now given up the entire advance, so we're right in the region of the trend mean. Well, the inspiring story is that it's going to be additive manufacturing, that there's going to be repatriation of jobs from overseas, and that we're all going to have access to 3D printing technology at home, and that we'll all be able to print off our own little knickknacks, and it'll be a wonderful independent way of generating income for creative types, for replacing lost bits and pieces for everybody else, and revolutionizing manufacturing. The challenge with 3D printing is scale and speed. And the reality is that injection molding is faster than 3D printing. There are obviously benefits for singular items, but it's just a challenge that the sector has been dealing with now for the better part of a decade. It went through a phenomenal bull market in 2012 through to 2013, and there was massive consolidation. There's really only three companies that are pure plays on the sector today, and they all pretty much look the same. And we're starting to see that the interest has come straight back out of them. Stratasys, having popped on the upside, has come all the way back down to the region of the trend mean. It was additionally weaker in here today. So if we're thinking about, well, which part of the market has been most acutely affected by this withdrawal of margin and speculative interest in the market? Well, it's in these meme shares. It's in the ones where you've had companies like ARK Investments bidding them up, and all you have to do is sign up for ARK Investments' email, and they'll send you a list of the companies that they're buying and selling every week. And that's an easy way to get access to all of the meme shares. Then, of course, you have the power of the retail investor and the Reddit army, and they have also been buying aggressively in the early part of the year and much less talked about now. So that is also representative of some of the heat coming out of the meme shares. And this, of course, is the challenge, that we do get a lot of enthusiasm for high growth when interest rates are extraordinarily low and there is no prospect of the magic money well drying up anytime soon. And I guess that is the that is also what they're referring to as the magic money tree, MMT. So when we think about, well, where are we then in terms of all of this? Well, the large companies continue to do well, and they didn't especially attract a lot of attention from the meme stocks at the beginning of this year. And that's because their share prices are just simply too large for most retail investors, despite the trend of fractional ownership being offered by various houses. It's a lot harder to move the price of a trillion-dollar company than it is for one that is in the hundreds of millions or even in the tens of millions. Amazon today is right in the region of the upper side of its range. It rallied quite impressively this week on the potential that they will split the stock and make it more amenable to the retail class of investor to buy it. But they came through with strong earnings, and then it did not rally. So the one company that has been very clear in what they think is going to happen next is eBay. And the share pulled back about 10% yesterday because they said that they don't believe that the bump that they got from the pandemic is going to persist. So the share has pulled back to the region of the trend mean. It was steady in here today, but it does raise the big question that a lot of companies did extraordinarily well during the pandemic because of a one-off jump in demand for their goods and services. For the cloud providers, they have done well all the way through the last 12 months and came through with very impressive earnings, and particularly for Amazon, for the web services division in here today. But the bigger question is, what happens next? Are they going to be able to grow at the same pace in the second, third, and fourth quarters of this year? And that looks unlikely. So we've definitely seen this exact same pattern unfolding this week, where Apple came through with strong earnings and then declined. Microsoft also came through with strong earnings and has also been declining. So even though Apple doesn't give guidance any longer, Microsoft, I think, is also representative of what's going on here. Facebook had a record quarter, and it popped right off the open on the upside, but then it wasn't able to hold on to it in here today. Google also had a very impressive quarter. I think I'm rather more favorable towards Google for the simple reason that they have been spending their money rather wisely, and they've been investing huge amounts in the next new thing. So they at least have a hedge against the potential that there is going to be some pause and consolidation in terms of their earnings growth as the wider economy does open up. So we've had this incredible advance in the retail sector. If we look at the online retail market, then we've certainly had some pause and consolidation, and the market, having been quite firm in the early part of the week, closed on the lower side of the range. So this ETF has gone from approximately 30 to 140 and now around 125 in a year. So even among the better performers, we've had a significant loss of momentum recently. Well, what this at least is highlighting is that we've had a great deal of risk taken off in just a short period of time. And certainly there's more of a rotation going on into what will do better in a recovery scenario. So the stay-at-home sector, or the stay-at-home index, has been one of the go-to areas to monitor the recovery off the lows in March, but it pulled back to the trend mean in February, and now it does look like it is rolling over. So then we can think about the semiconductors index. It seems like every single day there is a story about the chip shortage and how profound a challenge that is for a large number of sectors, particularly the industrials in trying to source them, and then also for the chip manufacturers in their attempts to meet demand. But the price is rolling over, and it has certainly isn't ramping higher any longer. So this is also representative of this the sector that did best in 2020 not doing as well in 2021. As we then think about, well, what should be expected to do well? Well, we know, for example, that copper this week has pushed through to test the $10,000 level. And it's at 9,900, or excuse me, 885 in at the close yesterday. This is on the cusp of completing a more than decade-long range. So, what we're looking at here is that there's the potential that we could have some consolidation. It's certainly not beyond the bounds of possibility that this big $10,000 area is going to represent a point where investors will start to wait and see what happens next. And having reached the big psychological level and knowing what happened last time it got up to these areas, well, then I think people will be more encouraged to simply wait and see before they start buying aggressively. But as we think about what's going to happen in the wider economy, I think we have to just think about what happened in 2020. Politicians were terrified. They introduced lockdowns. Now, the wisdom of the lockdowns will be debated infinitely, but the reality is that it was a panicky response, and that panic was in response to the unknown, but then they had to deal with really significant social unrest and a lot of people who are extremely ticked off. That translated into social unrest on the streets of the USA, on the streets of the UK and much of Europe, and for varying cultural reasons. So it was about social justice in the USA. It was also to a certain degree about social justice and Brexit in the UK. Then it was about immigration and then the tone of governance in much of Europe. Now we've at the climax of all those events, you had the invasion of the Capitol building in Washington, D.C., by a bunch of yahoos and people taking selfies in various offices. I mean, if it weren't so serious, it would be comical. But the reality is that for septuagenarian and octogenarian politicians who locked themselves in various offices while all this was going on, it was probably a terrifying event. Then we can think about what's happening in France today, where you have this letter circulating from retired generals complaining about the trajectory of governance in the country. And obviously, then that raises the threat of a coup. So these are also significant issues. So if one was just to simply try and empathize with politicians, what are they going to do? Well, It couldn't be simpler. The way to survive as a politician is to give the people what they want. And what they want is more spending. So we're going to see a significant increase in deficits. I've created this long-term view of deficits, and it tends to roll on a quarterly basis depending on which countries are reporting, but it's up to 2.6 trillion. So that's representative of the deficit spending of a large number of countries. So we can certainly think about the fact that margin debt is mod the growth in margin debt is moderating. And we can think about the potential that there's a significant rotation underway in the stock market, and that the habitual destroyers of capital are going to start to be punished, and that the stay-at-home sector is certainly at the risk, at least, of experiencing the kind of downdraft that the tech sector experienced after Y2K, because I think that there are very clear parallels. When we go back and think about what happened in 1999, it was simple, and of course simple in retrospect. But I remember I graduated university in 1999, and there were a couple of guys on the rowing team were studying e-commerce as part of their business degree. And they were already at that stage talking to venture capitalists and private equity firms for the simple reason that they had a degree in e-commerce. Well, I didn't know anything about markets at the time, but I thought that was seemed to be a pretty strange phenomenon. And back then, there was a race on to upgrade IT infrastructure. So everyone front-loaded their earning or their orders into 1999, so that by the time it rolled around to 2000, the Federal Reserve was raising interest rates and orders disappeared. We have to think that anyone who was going to migrate to the cloud did so in 2020. So we've seen a significant quarter in 2021 because we're not yet out of the pandemic. We can see where the exit is, and the number of people that are being vaccinated is going to increase substantially as we move through the rest of the year. And that's going to begin to raise questions about what happens next. Well, everyone who wanted to invest in the cloud has done so, so it's unlikely that the growth in the cloud sector is going to justify the multiples that they're currently sitting on. So when we look at the cloud computing sector, we can certainly think about the impressive rebound we've had from the trend mean. And it's still pausing here around the $100 level. If it sustains a move below the trend mean, well, then that will represent a significant inconsistency. So far, this is a somewhat larger pullback, but it is still holding the region of the trend mean. But certainly, the price accelerated in 2020. Now, if we then think about, well, what are governments going to do? They're going to spend. And they're going to try and spend in a way that will get as many people back to work as possible. They're also going to spend in a way that will try to improve living standards as quickly as possible, because it's the only possible way that these politicians are going to hold on to their jobs. So that's why the copper price is rallying. It's also why companies like Newmont Mining are beginning to talk about buying copper resources. Now, obviously, they're looking for copper gold resources, and they'll want to invest in size, and they estimate that by simply taking out just one big project, copper will represent about 20% of their productive capacity, or their revenue capacity. Now, there's a good reason why they're looking at copper, because the growth story for copper is impressive and secular in nature. And the much more important point is that by investing in copper production, they estimate they might be able to sidestep carbon costs, because copper is absolutely essential for the electrification of the global economy. And if we start to think about how is all of this spending going to be paid for, the things that politicians like to talk about because they make for splashy headlines is that they're going to raise taxes on the wealthy. They're going to cut back on the luxuries afforded people via inheritance. And those are exactly the kinds of things that people who are down on their luck want to hear. They want to hear that extraordinarily wealthy people are going to be made to pay. But that isn't going to come close to meeting the objectives of all the spending. The reality is that it's going to be everyone ends up paying. And that is why carbon credits are still trending higher. The EU wants this price up to 100. So it could double from here. And it's pointless to talk about the fact that it's accelerating or that it is way overextended relative to the trend mean, because this is a politically motivated price structure. The politicians want a higher carbon price. And that is also part of the reason why we've had this disappointing performance from Royal Dutch Shell. So they came through with extremely strong earnings this week. And they said that they are paying down debt, that earnings have returned to pre-pandemic levels, and the share declined. Well, it's not declining because there's something wrong with the business. It's declining for the simple reason that they don't have a simple plan for how they're going to circumvent the threat from rising carbon prices. So, and this is for a company that is most forward thinking in terms of how they can address the threats from the green lobby. Now, every single day I get an email from one source or another on our email newsletter talking about the threat of rising seas, of the speed with which the glaciers are melting, and the inevitability of drastic measures that need to be taken. We can also think about the droughts that are affecting different parts of the world. So, California is back in a drought. The second biggest reservoir is at less than half of the water it would have for this time of the year normally. Taiwan's drought is going into, and we're coming into the rainy season for Taiwan, so they are praying that they're going to have a normal season. And of course, fires have already started up in California. There were two in the last couple of days, small ones, but still we're at the beginning of the fire season. And all of this, it doesn't matter what the reality is or why California is having fires or the mountain pine beetle or the complete refusal to do thinning of the forests over many decades contributing to fire risk. All of that is completely irrelevant because the perception is that the world is on fire, that carbon is a major problem, and it is now one of the easiest ways for governments to raise taxes. So they absolutely need to spend the money because they're terrified of financial, or excuse me, they're terrified of people revolting and them losing their jobs and having a very disorderly environment overall. At the same time, they need to raise money, so they are going to continue to increase the cost of carbon. And the onus for paying that is going to be on the major polluters. So that is primarily the energy sector and the mining sector. And then, of course, the steel sector and the big industrials. Well, the at least if we think about the big steel companies, ArcelorMittal in listed in the Netherlands is coming up to the upper side of its base formation because steel is absolutely integral to building the renewable energy future. If we think about Gerdau, and I'm trying to remember the ticker, then that has completed its base formation and it has about half its earnings in Latin America and the other half in North America. Then, of course, we can think about the copper miners. They are hoping that they can circumvent the risk that they will also fall under the umbrella of carbon taxing. So it's a big question. How much are we going to see investment in mining? Because the silver miners stopped investing in pure silver because silver prices were extremely low. So they have all spent most of the last 5 or 6 years diversifying into gold. Now we're starting to see the big gold miners diversifying into copper. And that's only because they think that they'll have an easier time opening copper mines than gold mines. The premium that's attached to investing in a new mine is rising all the time. So mining executives are obviously worried about the cost of investing in new mines and the uncertainty of it all. And it's one thing to go to investors and say, well, we have this big carbon footprint that we're going to have to come up with, and we're going to have much more regulatory hurdles to overcome on t in terms of remediation of the mining site later. And we're not even sure that we're going to find what we're looking for. So that's a big hurdle, and it will require significantly higher prices for the industrial resources to justify a big new investment cycle. So that is supply inelasticity meets rising demand, and it suggests that we are now back in a secular bull market for industrial resources. And the big question that many investors have been asking is, are we ever going to see another China enter the global economy? That was the rationale for investing in commodities in the early 2000s, that China was building a new Manhattan every year. And that represented a secular bull market for commodities. Well, on this occasion, what we are looking at is a global phenomenon where the entire global economy is being refashioned so that carbon can be taxed and attempt and that used as an attempt to fill the hole that has been left in national balance sheets so that then they also can achieve energy independence. The big phenomenon over the course of the last decade has been that the USA went from being the biggest consumer to the one of the biggest exporters of oil and gas. So oil prices are still steady around the $60 area. We've started to see that excuse me, oil drilling companies are getting back in action. Natural gas prices have also started to steady, so that's also pricing in economic recovery. So we're in an interesting juncture here that natural gas is steadying because there is demand for it domestically, but also because European gas is surging higher and is coming up towards its all-time highs. And that, of course, is going to raise a bigger question about just how the carbon from a recovering energy sector can be taxed and used to fund the vanity projects of politicians everywhere. So that's one of the primary reasons I don't give a lot of credence to the view that we're going to move into a secular bull market for oil, or at least not until we see a substantial amount of potential supply taken out of the market. And we're just not there yet. And then, of course, we have this additional pressure of rising food prices. So the supply shortages that have occurred over the course of this year are not trivial in nature. And certainly the uptick in food prices. Now, certainly wheat is beginning to play catch up, but it was quite volatile for a couple of days and then steadied again in here today. Soybeans was up in a rather dynamic manner in here today. So this is also representative of continued demand for foodstuffs. As we talk about droughts, there's also a drought in Brazil around the coffee growing area. So Arabica coffee popped on the upside to test the 150 level in here earlier this week and is now pulling back in here over the last 2 days, and that was a downside Q reversal yesterday. Sugar prices had been also pushing higher, so this weakness, it may suggest that it started raining in Brazil. And we do have this short-term overbought condition as well. So we're looking at a globally recovering economy that is floating higher on this continued spending. There is also this question, and I was corresponding with my cousin in Melbourne last night, and she has been supplementing her pension for years by renting out her old family home. And she viewed herself as lucky because her tenants left voluntarily and they paid rent when they could. There's many other people who have been renting out apartments have been faced with tenants who are malingerers and just simply are not paying their rent and are not being pursued for it and can't be evicted. And this is a global phenomenon because it's happening in Melbourne, so it's Australia, it's certainly happening in the USA, and it's happening elsewhere as well. How do you get over this problem? Well, the only possible way to avoid significant social distress and a revolution by the progressive wing of leftist parties is to forgive the debts. And that is going to be ruinous for a large number of the people who are small landlords. Obviously, the bigger landlords are going to be in a similar condition, but they do tend to be better capitalized. Of course, when we think about Blackstone, they have continued to be really quite active in buying houses, and they are still buying houses, and that is one of the primary factors behind the continued commonality between the share price of Blackstone and lumber futures. So we can definitely think that investors are seriously involved in propelling the price of housing higher. They're looking for real assets because they believe that real assets will insulate them from the threat of inflation. Because it is inflation that is more likely. There's this rabid debate going on in the markets and a great deal of uncertainty being expressed about whether we're going to have an inflationary outcome or a deflationary outcome. On the inflationary side, we have these supply constraints that are going to take a while at least to unwind. And lumber pushed on almost limit up again in here today. Perhaps it is limit up, 48 might be the limit. And this is also emblematic of the short-term distress in terms of getting supply to the market. It's likely to be at least short-term in nature and unlikely to last beyond the next few months, but it is still a supply inelasticity argument because they simply can't get enough workers or open new mills fast enough to keep up with demand. When we think about the inflation argument, it's about wages. And wage growth is the number one, I think, item that can move the needle. So wage demand growth has been moderating because more people are back at work. So the change we had in the number of people that were out of work and then the wages that were being attained by people that were still at work created a dislocation in this price series, and it's still running at about 4.2%. Personal savings have continued to rally. So that's, I think, one of the more important points for the deflationary outcome. We're still at personal savings as a percentage of disposable income at about 27%. That's a lot. And if we are going to see this kind of precautionary saving persist, then it is going to be deflationary. I wonder, however, how deflationary it would be if people see that their cash holding is being eroded by inflation. And I think that's when people start to panic. So wage growth is one factor that would contribute to an inflationary outcome. Then it's the perception of inflation and how that changes investor and consumer behavior. One of the reasons why the deflationary outcome persisted in Japan was because living standards decreased. And after the go-go years of the 1980s, Japan had to live with this debt burden. So people stopped spending. They became much more conservative in their outlook, and they made do with less. And that completely affected the way that they spent and the way that they lived their lives. Well, the big difference between that occasion and now is that consumers are cash rich, and particularly so in the USA. And as house prices continue to advance, and against a background of financial repression, and I do believe that we are still going to have financial repression, because you might have people like Jens Weidmann at the ECB saying today that the central bank has to ignore the funding costs of governments, and that if inflation starts to appear, they need to move in quickly and stamp it out. And that will certainly read well in Germany, but it's not going to fly for the rest of Europe. And it's certainly not going to be part of the lexicon in the USA. The Federal Reserve has said in plain English that they're not going to raise interest rates until they see evidence of inflation trending higher. And they are unlikely to raise interest rates if it's going to represent a significant hole in government finances. And that hole in government finances question is a big one, because if interest rates were to rise in a meaningful fashion, then that would represent a very significant threat to the ability of the government to fund their spending programs. So we've had a meaningful move in yields, and it's come all the way up to about 1.75%. And we've seen over the course of the last few weeks that the yield is starting to come back down. Now, this has been small moves so far. I'm still holding my long in Treasury futures because I think that we're due a reversion to the mean. I think we're probably due some disappointment in the economic recovery, that we're due some consolidation in the stock market, and that will contribute to demand for yields. And it might even contribute to some additional demand for the dollar. But I don't think that these are going to be anything other than short-term moves. So we may see some deflationary threats coming through in the short term. And that will only further fortify the intentions of central banks to print as much money as is required, and for governments to further increase their spending. There's still a debate going on about whether the aggressive spending plans announced by the Biden administration this week will in fact be passed. But if we see deflationary forces starting to manifest again, or some disappointing economic activity in the second quarter, then it's quite likely that support for all this trillions in additional spending will rapidly coalesce around that argument. And I think that this is integral to what happens with Bitcoin. So Bitcoin's price was up in an aggressive manner today. It was up, I think, about $4,000. And we had the upside key reversal at the beginning of the week. So this is at least a near-term low around the $50,000 level. Now, the point that I've been harping on about for the last 2 months has been that the trend is no longer consistent. And I think I will reiterate my points, that we had a really beautiful staircase step sequence uptrend in Bitcoin all the way up from the lows in March, where you had one range above another and every single one of the breakouts was sustained. And that persisted all the way through until March. And then breakouts started to fail. And then we saw that the sequence of higher reaction lows was broken. And on top of that, when we think about momentum markets, then we see that it's often the 50-day moving average is the one that people pay the greatest attention to. And that is now representing a potential area of resistance. And it had been an area of support from the beginning of October, or the middle of October, all the way until quite recently. So I don't spend a lot of time looking at the 50-day moving average because it's really only useful in a strong momentum move. But I don't really have any doubt that a lot of traders keep an eye on it. So this is a critical juncture here, and we're heading into the weekend, and we often see volatile trading in Bitcoin over the weekend because the market is less liquid and a lot of people still take the weekend off. So the big question is, what's going to happen on Saturday night, and will we see Bitcoin pushing up and through the 57,000 level, or is it going to fail here? Now, we've definitely seen a lot more interest in these stock to flow charts. It was a really very successful institutional trader turned me on to this chart back in early March, and it gives us the quantity of or the stock to flow. So it looks at the price, it looks at how long we are away from the most recent halving, or the next halving I should say. And then it also looks at the amount of interest, or as Charlie Morris says, the network strength of the Bitcoin price. So one thing that we can certainly think about is that there were major peaks in 2013 and 2017, and those are 4 years apart. And the halvenings are 4 years apart. And each of those peaks in 2013 and in 2017 occurred with about 1,000 days, maybe a little bit more than 1,000 days before the next halving. So we are not so far away from 1,000 days. We can also think about the stock to flow estimate, and it's not really all that far away either. So these, I think, are some of the most important points. We have seen Bitcoin lose consistency, and it is now at a level where we could start to think that there have been peaks in the past. Now, we can definitely see that it's in the point where it turns to green, and that on each of the previous occasions, it has come above this price to flow line. So there is an argument based upon just the commonality that we have in this trend that Bitcoin could yet pop on the upside and then multiply in value. And that's exactly what happened in 2017. So in a very short period of time, Bitcoin went up a lot. Between November and the end of December, Bitcoin went from 5,000 to 20,000. So that was the blow-off peak, and then it subsequently crashed and lost 80% of its value. And I think that that is the most relevant consideration. We're now at the point in the cryptocurrency markets that there's either going to be bubbly activity, similar to what we saw in 2017, or we are going to go through a lengthier period of consolidation overall. So when we go through these lengthy periods of consolidation in Bitcoin, it has tended to come back down and test the region of the 1,000-day moving average. And the 1,000-day moving average right now, and I'll need to put this on a 200-week average to see it, and we'll see that the 1,000-day moving average is now around $11,890. So if we see a pop on the upside, we could easily see the price go up and multiply from there. When it eventually does collapse, then it will likely come back and test the region of the 1,000-day moving average. And by the time it gets there, that moving average will have risen up substantially to follow the price rises higher. So we're at really a critical juncture. We've had a loss of consistency. Now, often big trends will lose consistency at the penultimate highs. We may, in fact, be seeing that today. And what happens over this weekend will probably inform that view. Now, of course, the evolution of Bitcoin and the altcoins and the non-fungible tokens and central bank digital currencies, they all represent a big question about the future of money. And there is absolutely no denying that there is a war on cash, and there is a clear intention of governments to inflate their debts away. And if you're going to default, well, if you know you're going to default, you have a clear incentive to borrow as much money as you possibly can. And that clearly seems to be the intention of governments. So they're going to bankrupt themselves and do it en masse. And subsequently, they'll then adopt a hard currency like Bitcoin, or not Bitcoin, but a digital currency. And once they adopt digital currencies, they'll outlaw the ownership of the other altcoins. And that will represent the end of the bull market. Now, they won't be able to outlaw the mining of Bitcoin, but they don't have to. All they have to do is ban the ownership of it and make it illegal and put a couple of high-profile owners in jail, and that will irreparably kill off institutional demand. And when you've got a market cap of $1 trillion, and if the bulls get what they want, which is an additional acceleration, several trillion in market cap, then you are relying on institutional money. And institutions all over the world are making this decision today. They're deciding whether they should change their investment documentation to allow for investing in cryptocurrencies. And that's been fueled by the success of their competitors. Because in a momentum-driven bull market, the people who cast caution to the wind are those that do best, those that embrace the new bull market hypothesis as gospel. They are the people that do best, and they look like geniuses, and their ability to predict the market looks prophetic. And as long as prices are rising, then that will continue to be a reinforcing trend. But when the market turns and money starts to come out, then it has the exact opposite effect. The time to be most active as a buy and hold investor is when prices are low and volatility is high. And the time to be most cautious about taking profits and refusing to pay up is when everyone is trying to convince you how little risk there is in the market, and that the price, having multiplied several times already, is going to do so again. Well, we're in the gambling part of the market today, because the price could multiply a couple of times from here, or it could lose 80% of its value. So we have this binary trade. This is no longer investing, and one would have to have a very long-term perspective with tolerance for extraordinary volatility in order to buy today on a buy and hold basis, in the hope that when we reach out to 2028 or 2029, the price will be somewhere in the order of $200,000 to $250,000, or perhaps even the big million. It's not to say that that's impossible. We could get there. There is absolutely no limit to the extraordinary heights that a bubbly environment can reach. But the bigger question is whether it's going to happen now. And that, at least, the loss of consistency gives me some pause in thinking about that. I do think that there is great value in the cryptocurrency sector. The evolution of altcoins and their various ability to solve the inconsistencies, and I think in the inability of Bitcoins to scale and to actually provide a route to financial transactions, the ability of the altcoins to solve those problems is certainly going to be part of our future. But then the bigger question is, what is the future of a hard asset like Bitcoin when it is susceptible to intervention by regulators? Because it's a completely unregulated market. And as we look at the market cap exceeding $1 trillion, then it is inviting regulation. And regulation is something that is going to be allergic for a lot of investors who have been the stalwart supporters of Bitcoin over the course of its history. At the same time, we can think about gold. Many of the same arguments can be leveled at gold, but it's held by central banks, and it's not a competing force to central banks. The price continues to pause here around the $1,800 area. We just have not yet had the clear dynamic moves to conclude, to confirm that more than a short-term low has been found. We're still in this volatile trading environment, but I remain very much of the view that we are heading back towards a financial repression environment, and that central banks are going to tolerate greater inflation. This performance of gold and the commonality it has with bond markets, I don't think it's going to last indefinitely, but it's certainly evident at present, and eventually something will have to act as a catalyst to break the relationship. I do, however, think that bonds are oversold and due a bounce, and then that should translate into gold offering higher beta to that particular trend. And I think with that, I'm going to leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.